It's that time again. Welcome back to the 3ND podcast. I am your host, Justin Lewis. You can find the podcast at 3ND pod on Twitter. You can find me at J_TimberFake_. As always, we're a part of the Grizzly Bear Blues network of podcasts, and you can follow us over at SBN Grizzlies on Twitter and grizzlybearblues.com to see everything that we've got going on. And I'm super excited about today's episode. We have the captain, the godfather, the leader of the ship, Joe Mullinax, on the podcast. Joe, how you doing?
The Undertaker. I think that's going to be my new bit that I'm going to keep bringing up. I'm the Undertaker of Grizzlies blogging. I refuse to die, refuse to retire. I just keep hanging around. So I'm doing okay. I'm happy to be on here. I'm really excited about the structure of 3ND. You've done a remarkable job taking the reins when Sean Coleman left. And now we're going to use 3ND, obviously anchored by you, as an opportunity for other GBB writers to get their voice on podcasts and kind of have a revolving door of hosts. So I'm excited. It's my turn. This is going to be fun. And you have a terrific guest for us to lead off with.
Yes, we do have an awesome guest, and I'm glad that you have given us this opportunity. Our guest is none other than Matt Moore from the Action Sports HQ. I was just looking at it, and it slipped my mind. Matt, tell us where we can find you. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what you guys do over there.
Hey, glad to be on with you guys. Yeah, I'm Matt Moore. I'm the senior NBA writer over at the Action Network. You can find me on Twitter at HB Basketball. And yeah, the Action Network, we do hardcore analysis for the invested sports fan. So if you're into gambling, great site for you. But even if you're not, you're going to learn something each and every single time you check out our site. We have an awesome app. It's also the fastest app for tracking stats. Like if you're out and you can't watch the games and you want to know what's happening, you want to be on ours, because I've actually tracked it. Our app updates the score faster than the TV does. The live TV feed, because I've been at games and been watching the TV and the actual game itself, and our score updates before even the TV does. So make sure to check that out, the Action Network app.
Wow, that's something I'm going to have to download, because I do get frustrated with the delay and updates sometimes when I'm watching games. If you guys do not follow Matt on Twitter, he is an awesome follow. You guys need to make sure you do that. Matt, tell him where you are on Twitter again.
At HP Basketball.
Yes, you will definitely enjoy following Matt, interacting with him on there. Joe, I'm going to start with you. We have the recent news on Justice Winslow's injury, which for all of us Grizzlies fans that were anticipating seeing him, and we're excited about that. It's a kind of a heartbreaker. Tell us about the impact basketball-wise that that's going to have on the Grizzlies in the bubble.
Well, I think it's convenient that people are trying to minimize it. Obviously, Winslow hasn't played a ton this season, and by a ton, I mean at all. But at the same time, one of the silver linings in this, you know, craptacular year of 2020 is the idea that with the NBA resuming and essentially an offseason between the last game there in the middle of March and the restart now in Orlando, you have Justice Winslow, who gets healthy after the Andre Iguodala trade. Winslow comes from Miami. He's a versatile player who can play every position, number one through four on the floor. He even played a little bit of center for the Heat at times. That wasn't really successful, so I don't see Taylor Jenkins doing that with Justice at any point. But he can play multiple positions. You know, Parker Fleming, our associate editor, talks about positionless basketball, and Justice Winslow, in theory, fits that bill. One of the things I was most excited about with Justice was his ability to facilitate offense. Because if Memphis is going to have success both short-term in the bubble and long-term beyond this season, they need as many facilitators as possible, as many guys that can create off the dribble for themselves and others as possible, so that John Morant can be more of a scorer. People love seeing the passes that John Morant does, cross-court, one-handed, launching the ball. He's fun to watch, and he really does prioritize getting his teammates involved first before he gets himself his points, and that kind of fleshes itself out with his fourth quarter scoring that he does. But he can't just be a fourth quarter scorer. He needs to be a four quarter scorer. And I want to give, I believe it was Anthony Sane the first time that I heard that phrase. That's a great way to put it. It can't just be one frame where he prioritizes getting himself going offensively. He's the superstar. He's the stud. He is the one that's going to stir the drink for the Grizzlies offense moving forward. And of course, that as the point guard, he has to initiate offense for others, but he's going to be the lead scorer for this team too. So when you see video clips like what the Grizzlies posted, I believe it was a day or so ago, where Brandon Clark throws an alley-oop from the elbow, and it's Ja Morant somehow catching the ball in midair, redirecting mid-jump and slamming it home. That's what we want to see more of, because it allows for Ja to be coming off of backdoor cuts and coming off screens off the ball and getting in different positions to get the ball for himself to be a primary scorer instead of being a primary facilitator more consistently. Justice Winslow would have been able to do that, and he would have been able to do that better than anybody currently on the Grizzlies roster, including Kyle Anderson, who that is a strength of his. But Justice Winslow has the athleticism. He has the capacity to be able to stick with guards, play against point guards defensively. Some of the best basketball he played in Miami was as a point guard for the Heat. He's not that long term, but with Memphis, he would have been a really solid match with Morant, because it would have allowed for Ja to expose himself in terms of scoring at a higher clip. It could have given him an opportunity to really explore what he can do as an off-ball scorer more, which Memphis is going to need, like I said, if they want to make the playoffs, if they want to steal a game or two from the Lakers, and then even further down the road than that, they really were counting on, in my opinion, Winslow to give that ability in a larger sense and still be a decent three-point shooter. In the two seasons that Winslow really had success in Miami, he was a pretty solid guy from beyond the arc. So he's a bigger threat than a Kyle Anderson from range. He has the capacity to create offense for himself and others, and that would have helped somebody like Ja, who is going to essentially have what he had before, which isn't bad, but it's not as good as it could have been.
Right, and one of the things I was most excited about in the Winslow trade was his time that he played in Miami at the point guard position when Dragic had went down. That team went to a different level, it seemed like. It was really exciting to watch. And then, of course, he would be an upgrade behind the arc over Kyle Anderson, and so that was exciting too. But even, and I think in our minds, we were just immediately like, we should insert him into the starting lineup, and it doesn't look like Kyle or that Taylor Jenkins – ever had that intention. From what we see from the social media posts, Winslow was going to be a second unit guy. Anderson was still going to start, and the Grizzlies were 8-3 with Anderson starting at the three. And so really, why would you change that up? Because you got this new toy to play with. I don't know. I think that, you know, we made it this far without Winslow being in there. Sure, the last, you know, couple of weeks of practices, they've been working on putting him into the system, but they can just go right back to what they were doing beforehand that was successful. So, Matt, we're going to transition to you. How much does this affect the way that you view the Grizzlies when it comes to betting on the Grizzlies going in the bubble, when it comes to future bets and game-by-game bets? How much does he shift that line?
He doesn't, quite honestly. And it's not that I don't think that Justice is a good player, that he won't be a good player long term, or that the trade was bad. But, you know, he only played 11 games this season for Miami, and he was just – he's been injury prone. That's been a problem for him. Three-point variance has been a really big issue with him. So in his career, he shot below 30% his first two seasons. Then he shot 38% and 38% consecutive years. And it was like, all right, he's kind of figured it out. And then he shot really terribly in those 11 games this season. There's been a lot of questions about his consistency with three-point shooting. And that's a big part of this. Honestly, like, the big takeaway for me with the Winslow injury is mostly that I wish they had not done the trade until the offseason, not because he got hurt, because you can't know that's going to happen, but how valuable would it be to have Crowder and Solomon Hill right now? Because those guys played really well for Memphis and were able to knock down shots, especially in key clutch situations, and they needed that. Everything that Joe said about the shot creation and being able to have another creator on the floor is definitely true. But one thing that if we're looking at, if we're going to just narrow it down to the remaining games, is you need to be able to just come up with a little bit of shot variance and be able to knock down some quality looks. And without Crowder and Hill and now Winslow out of the equation as well, you're just more shorthanded in terms of what you're able to do in producing threes. And that's going to be difficult because most of the teams on their schedule are like that. The Grizzlies have a really mediocre half court offense. Like, that's just the reality of it. Is per Synergy Sports, they're 21st in half court offense. Now they're 10th in transition because they fly up and down the court and are able to get buckets. And I think that that's going to get them probably into the play-in game, but I'd have a lot more confidence in their ability to make good on their make playoffs bet and wouldn't be fading them the way that I am, you know, if they had a little bit more weaponry to rely on. Cause as it stands now, like, they need, you know, Dylan Brooks is going to have to be like a supernova. Like, he's going to have to be really great. And he was great this season, but he's going to have to make some big time shots for them in order to keep up the kind of variance. Cause teams are going to key in consistently on Jot. That's maybe the big takeaway here is I'll probably look for the under a little bit because Memphis's totals are always a little high, because teams, when they're in this environment and there's more scouting, will likely key in on Ja a lot more to throw multiple levels of defense at him. And that maybe open up things for Jaren Jackson and Dylan Brooks, but I do think it's going to make things a little bit difficult for their offense that already struggles in the half court.
Right. Their half court offense is, with Kyle in the mix, is reminds me of the series with the Warriors and the Grizzlies where Andrew Bogut guarded Tony Allen from the paint, and it just completely disrupted everything that Memphis was doing. So, like, not having Winslow out there is going to definitely affect that. Let me ask you this real quick, Matt, and then I'm going to ask Joe something. Do you think that getting Grayson Allen or Josh Jackson into the lineup helps create any of that shot variance that you're talking about?
I think Grayson definitely does. You know, Grayson's versatile enough to be able to, if he gets hot, that can definitely, like, one thing I try and identify in playoff situations, and these games are going to be very playoff-like. Like, every game is going to matter a lot for the Grizzlies. One thing I try and identify is who are the guys that the other team's fans are just going to be like, oh my God, we're getting killed by this guy. This guy's killing us. And certainly Memphis has had a fair share of those along the way with various Clippers and other team, other guys along the way. But I think Grayson Allen is one that could really step in and actually produce there and help them in that respect. Josh Jackson, I can't go there. Like, he's just going to have to show me that he can be on the floor and be productive and actually contribute in a consistent way to where he's not a net negative before I can really get on board with the idea that he's going to be able to help out. Cause a lot of it is Jackson, I don't think, is comfortable with just being a specific role spot up shooter. That's part of it is, you know, Crowder and Hill, again, to go back to that, is like those guys that know their role. If they've been in the NBA long enough, they understand what they need to do. And Crowder definitely sometimes went too far. Like, he always believes he's capable of more than he can. But I do think I just can't get there with Jackson to believe that he's going to be a major difference maker.
Joe, I want to give you a chance to kind of say something too. This is the first time I've heard this. I don't know if you've heard this. Matt saying that he wishes that we would have waited to make this trade in the off season. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's disappointing, Matt. I hated Jay Crowder as a Memphis Grizzly, if I'm being completely honest. His leadership skill, I think that there's value to that for a young team. But he shot 29% from three, and he took shots away from guys like Jaren Jackson Jr. He, like you said, he was a chucker, a willing one, and he's obviously been much better for Miami, so that trade worked out for the Heat in that respect. But I just really struggle with the idea of Jay Crowder being someone. I feel like he's somebody that kind of lives off of veteran presence, right? He lives off of this idea of what Jay Crowder was in Boston and then even in his other stops along the way, and even to an extent when he was with Utah. But he just wasn't that for the Grizzlies. And I don't know that they're going to miss him all that much because, to be honest with you, Josh Jackson, in terms of transition, is a better fit running up and down the floor, the flying that you mentioned. Per cleaning the glass in almost every transition category, Josh Jackson is elite. He's in the top 5 or 10% of the NBA when it comes to being able to play in transition. He's shooting better from three than Jay Crowder did, and he shoots a heck of a lot less of them. And that's even with Jackson kind of filling that void left behind by Crowder. I wrote an article a few weeks ago in which I said Jackson should be the guy if Justice was healthy in the 10-man rotation, because at least Josh is willing to shoot that three. If Ja drives to the basket, defense collapses on Morant in the paint, and he kicks out to the corner. We've seen multiple examples of Kyle Anderson doing a super slow Sam Young-esque pump fake and then driving around and trying to find somebody else in terms of passing. At least we know Josh will take that shot, or he has the athleticism to create off the dribble. So I'm in no way, shape, or form a Josh Jackson truther. I do think that his legend is being built up a bit among Grizzlies fans. I don't think he's somebody that's better than, say, as an all-around basketball player, Kyle Anderson. Obviously, he's a better offensive threat. But like D'Anthony Melton, I think D'Anthony Melton is much better than Josh Jackson. He was when the trade was done last year, and he still is now.
Yeah.
But I do think Josh is a better fit for what Taylor Jenkins is trying to do than Jay Crowder was. And depending on the usage of him, I'm not sure they'll miss Crowder as much. Now, Solomon Hill is interesting because of what he was able to do as that pseudo 3-4. He didn't play outside of himself. Crowder, as you alluded to, does that a ton. He took way too many shots. He was way too aggressive. So I think that that's kind of the disconnect there, is what Crowder was for Memphis as to what he has been for the Heat. It's a real big, drastic difference.
I mean, look, I get what you're saying. And look, I look, the numbers will back up everything that you're alluding to with Crowder. A lot of it is situational, where if I look at the big wins that Memphis had this season, a lot of the key games that I would have circled in on, a lot of those where I would notice Crowder would make high quality plays in key moments, especially on the defensive end. This is a lot of it. It's like, look, when Memphis started to take off, their defense improved. And in order for you to be good defensively, you're going to need, you have to know what you're doing. It's knowledge based. And Josh Jackson's knowledge base defensively is sub basement. It is subterranean. And that is a real issue. Like on the court with John Morant, they've got a 109.8 defensive rating when he's on the court with John Morant this season. And that's going to be really tough versus the kind of teams that they're going to be facing. And Crowder, look, the numbers are bad with Crowder. I'm not going to deny that at all. And again, I fully admit the idea of like he takes too many shots, but you're all, I can hear in you also the thing that I hear a lot, which is he was taking shots away from Jared. Look, okay, the fun players are not going to get all the shots. Other guys going to get the shots in.
Sure.
And that's part of the component as well. Look, D'Anthony Melton is an interesting counter here, right? Like if Melton can continue the kind of play I think we've seen, like I think he's got a real capacity to be an impact player. Like he's a guy like I would really circle as being able to make a significant impact. But ultimately, like you talked about Jackson's ability to run up and down the floor. Like I'm not worried about like if John Morant is on the court, I am not worried about the Grizzlies scoring in transition. Like he is too talented, too skilled, and able to make too many plays too many ways. And also they're just extremely well coached in transition. Like their execution in terms of spacing, I'm all on board with. They will be able to score. So like I don't know what Jackson brings other than what they're already good at versus I need guys that can actually get it done in these specific environments. And that's where I kind of come down on a lot of it. Like bear in mind is not just Jackson. Like we overlooked this, but I just thought Solomon Hill was really good in the limited minutes that he gave this season for Memphis. And especially look, if you're in this environment and you're trying to make the playoffs, you need veterans. And I'm not trying to be cliche with that. It's just, when I asked coaches about that, I was like, why is this? Like, why is this cliche so true? And the response I got from whenever I asked this was, it's not just experience, it's knowledge base. It's I know if X happens, I need to Y, and I need to, and I have enough understanding of my teammates to know I have to tell this other guy to do Z. And that kind of communication is really pivotal. And look, all of this may get fixed by the fact that Jonas Valanciunas, I think, is an underrated part of this equation as well, where like he can just do a lot. Like he just fills in a lot of holes. But for me, like, look, Crowder's numbers are horrible. I'm not denying. I know it seems insane to suggest that, but I want situations, if I'm Memphis and I'm the plucky underdog, which they are, I want them to be in specific situations to steal games. Crowder's the kind of guy that will lose you an entire game and win you a fourth quarter. And I like those kind of guys to be able to help out in specific situations.
All right. That was, for me, a lot of fun to listen to. Let me ask you this, Matt. I'm looking at some Vegas odds, and it doesn't make much sense to me why the Grizzlies would be the favorite to win the 8 seed, but then be behind the Pelicans and the Blazers to win the conference and to win the finals. How does that work?
So a lot of it's they're just from where they're starting at, right? And the Pelicans – there's a couple things here. The Grizzlies are starting with such an advantage that whenever I try to like kind of game this out, and I'm not running projections of a statistical model, but I'm instead just looking at like, here's what I expect to happen and where do they end up? There are just so few situations in which Memphis does not wind up at least in the play-in versus New Orleans and Portland are not going to be in the play-in. One of those two is likely to be in the play-in. New Orleans far more so than Portland, based off of every projection that I've seen. But that's kind of where the difference is. And then once you get into a playoff environment, there's two things that work there. You have to think about this not from an estimation of how the bookmakers are evaluating odds, but they're also estimating where the money is going to come from. And if your liability, you have a lot more confidence in the Grizzlies. The Grizzlies are going to get low handle no matter what. They're a small market team with largely unrecognizable stars, even with the rookie of the year, versus Zion Williamson and Damian Lillard. Those guys are always going to get more random bets from either casual bettors that are just going to take a shot in the dark, or from pros that are like, oh, I'm going to put a little bit in on this. As a long shot, their risk is going to be a lot lower with Memphis because nobody will bet on them, versus they have to lower the odds of the other two because Zion alone is enough for people to get just completely carried away. Like, my position is going to be, it does not matter who wins the eighth seed. I am betting Lakers 4-0. Like, I'm betting the Lakers 4-0 in a sweep and probably going to get pretty good plus money on it. And I'm excited to take that bet no matter who it is. Whoever wins the eighth seed is getting stomped by the Lakers. They are going to get absolutely just destroyed by a much better team. These Western Conference eight seed teams, even Memphis, they're all extremely flawed, even relative to most normal eight seed Western Conference teams. But that's where this kind of dynamic plays into, is the perception of Dame and Zion is such that you're going to attract more casual bettors that are willing to take those long shots, which increases the risk that the book is going to hold on those teams. No one is going to bet Memphis to win the title. You might get somebody that's like, I think Portland can get hot. And that's not going to happen. And the books will happily take that money, but they also have to manage the risk evaluation on it.
All right. So my next question with that is, I'm looking at the lines for the first set of games, and Memphis is a 1.5 dog to Portland. So in my mind, if Memphis is going to be a dog to Portland, is there a pretty good chance that they're going to be the dogs in probably 7 of their 8 matchups, which the only one they're going to be a favorite would be against San Antonio?
Yeah, you can expect that. They're going to be dogs in all these games based off of the evaluations. Like, Memphis, again, so much of this is also built on how this goes with where the money is going to come from. And Memphis historically just does not attract a lot of bets. They just don't. Sharps will go in on them in specific situations. But for the most part, you're going to see them being underdogs consistently because all of those other teams are going to collect way bigger handle. Like, whenever they face any of these teams that have a significant public position the public really likes, they're just going to be they're going to get bumped by 3 or 4 points, and that's going to make them good to bet on. Like, I'll probably be betting the Grizzlies in certain key spots against the spread just because they're going to be extremely underrated by casual bettors, and that's going to influence the book where they'll open at, say, -3.5, and then they'll have to move dramatically. Like, they'll just have to move dramatically on any of the major teams. They will get pounded on them by the favorites, and that'll, I think, create an opportunity to bet on Memphis because they've been profitable this season.
So if you had to make one sure bet on the Grizzlies in the bubble, what would it be?
I've already taken positions to fade them a little bit because I'm worried about them in the play-in. Everyone kind of assumes that if they get the eighth seed that they can win it's like, oh, but all you gotta do is win one. And I'm like, that makes me nervous. Like, that just really makes me nervous to look at the idea of, I think, in with a shortened schedule and all these things going on, I'm worried about them being able to win to be able to get one of the two. It's not a knock on them. It's just like, look, these are random. Like, if they get solidly beat by New Orleans in the first game and they just have like a random bad performance, like they just can't hit water, if they fall out of a boat, that's it. Probably the one bet that I would square the most on would be probably for the eight seed. You're still getting plus money on that. And with Zion Williamson's absence, I just don't know how this is going to impact things. He's still out. They're expecting a 4-day quarantine, but that assumes that he tests negative the whole time that he's out and that nothing weird else happens. And we're a week away from the start of games. Like, there's a window in here where Zion could probably, if things get hung up and he misses some time, that opens the door even more for Memphis to get there. And it also, if Zion misses time, it opens the door for other teams to get in. If Portland gets in, I'm going to be hammering Memphis. If it's a play-in and it's Portland versus Memphis, I'm hammering Memphis in that game because I think they can beat them. And most of those teams, I think they can beat. But I do have some reservations about specific matchups, which is why I'll probably wait to see what the play-in games actually look like.
Gotcha. All right, as we wrap up, I'm going to turn this one over to Joe. He's got something that he wants to throw your way.
Yeah, but I changed my mind on what it was going to be, Justin. I hope that's okay.
Because yeah.
In the course of this entire conversation, we've talked a lot about Portland. We've talked a lot about New Orleans, and I think rightfully so. In an article that I wrote this week, Matt, I put Sacramento as the number one team that I'm worried about. And maybe that's just post-traumatic stress disorder from watching De'Aaron Fox beat up on Ja Morant so much this year. But I am really nervous if the Kings get to that play-in situation because I think they're just a really bad matchup, starting with Fox versus Morant. You know, Ja really struggled with Fox. And I do believe that, you know, whether it's Kent Bazemore, you know, you have Harrison Barnes, obviously Buddy Hield. There's lots of different pieces there for Sacramento. And Memphians, fans of the Grizzlies, should know what a strong motivator feeling like the world is against you is. And if anybody has that more than Memphis, it's Sacramento because nobody is talking about them and they are in the same lane as Portland and New Orleans. And oh, by the way, they have two games against the Pelicans. So if they find a way to knock off New Orleans, especially in this weird transition time where there's no Zion, if there is no Zion, then you're looking at Sacramento being in that mix. And all of a sudden, that's a pretty tough matchup for Memphis too. So how do you think Sacramento fits in all of this?
Here's the problem with the Kings. Before we get into the fact that De'Aaron Fox has already sprained his ankle, and we get into the fact
I did not see that.
Yeah, and the fact that Marvin Bagley has an injury. And is out an indeterminate amount of time. You have this. Their schedule on the surface looks very doable. You're like, oh, they could beat the Spurs and they could beat the Magic. And Dallas is tough, but that's winnable. They got two games versus the Pelicans. They face Brooklyn. Their only really tough games are Houston and L.A., and L.A. is the last game of the season when L.A. is probably resting. Here's the problem. The Kings, more than any other team inside campus, more than any team, including the Wizards, mind you, have the most random win profile. They don't beat good teams and lose to bad ones. They don't beat bad teams and lose to good ones. It's just a coin flip. It's every single friggin' night. You do not know what you're getting with the Kings, other than if teams take care of business and they're good, most times, more often than not, they'll win. The Kings' win profile is just abysmal. And so that combined with there's no discernible like play style. Like, okay, we go down the list, right? And Fox is good. I think Morant's better. Fox is great. I think Morant's a little bit better. You just go down the rosters of like the best player, second best player on down, and you just wind up being like, I think Memphis probably has all the better ones. I think Memphis is better coached. I think Luke Walton's really struggled in that respect. He's done bad things with Buddy Hield, just flat out bad things with Buddy Hield. He's made Buddy Hield a worse player, and that I think is concerning. I will also tell you, there's another team at the bottom that I'm really worried about for Memphis. I'm worried about San Antonio. I think that everyone is overlooking this because everyone's like, oh, they lost to Marcus Aldridge. What are they going to do? They are going to shoot more threes. That's what they're going to do. Do you want a Spurs team that shoots more mid-range shots from DeMar DeRozan and LaMarcus Aldridge, or a team that plays five-out Spurs basketball, passing, moving, and shooting? By the way, the Spurs were better on offense and defense with Aldridge off the court this season. You want Greg Popovich in a play-in environment? Is that the matchup that you want to see after everything Memphis has been through with Pop? I do not. So the Spurs are the one team that I keep looking at and being like, look, if they just reorient their offense to all perimeter, they're going to make me really nervous if I'm one of the teams that's in that 8-seed contention.
Great. Now I have a fourth team to be terrified of.
That's yep. Fantastic.
Thanks a lot, Matt. I appreciate that.
That's fine.
As the site manager of GrizzlyBearBlues.com, I'm going to lose sleep now because of four squads, not just three. That's fantastic. I appreciate it.
Well, Matt, we appreciate you coming on, taking some time out of your day. It was great. And Joe, thank you for joining us and being a part of it as well. Any last words from either one of you?
I hope Memphis gets the 8-seed. I think it sucks that they have to fight for it, considering what they had done to get there. I don't like that the league gave the Pelicans so many opportunities and that everyone's rooting against Memphis to make it. And I very much hope that Memphis shoves it in all their faces and Ja dunks on all of them, and that they get to be the team that is swept by the Lakers.
I think Dylan Brooks is somebody to watch going into the scrimmages, see how he looks in terms of his shooting stroke. The player with the biggest variance in terms of success and failure for Memphis in wins and losses was Dylan Brooks. So keep an eye on him.
No offense to you, Joe, but Matt may have had the best closing statement on the podcast that we've had. All right, for Matt and for Joe, this has been another episode of the 3 and D podcast. We'll see you guys next week.